The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why was terrorism an idea you wanted to explore with your writing?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for framing the question like that, for asking it as a matter of exploration, because both writing and reading is a way of exploring ideas. Now, the idea of terrorism, in particular, the idea of suicide terrorism, puzzled me. It confused me. It worried me. And I wanted to understand it better, to understand something that's in the world right now. And suicide terrorism is a very complicated violence. And I started to notice that in the dominant narratives, the stories that we tell ourselves about terrorism, that complexity seemed to be falling out. I was looking at the narratives in the news, and I was looking at the way people talk about terrorism, and I thought, wow, this is not full. We're not thinking about this enough. And I don't begin to pretend that I'm an expert. But one thing I do know, we need to think about this deeply and in many, many ways if we're going to find a solution to what I think is one of our biggest problems.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that's all about the literature of the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, and I'm talking with Blythe Woolston about her young adult novel, Black Helicopters.
Your story is about a girl named Valley who was raised by her father, who has anti-government views. And I think you're right when you say we're not looking at the full picture, because as I was reading the book, I thought, now I can see what it would be like to grow up with that indoctrination that then brings you to a point where you're walking around with a bomb on your chest. So tell us about her. Tell us about this character you've created.
There are other terrorists in other novels, young adult and otherwise. I, however, chose to tell this story from the first person, and I chose not to have it a simple story where she gets saved in the end. Okay, maybe that spoils the story for some people, but you need to understand this about suicide terrorism. Their happy ending is different than the one you might imagine for them. And so this person actually started to develop in my thinking. And she was based in many ways on me. I'm not a terrorist.
Oh, thank you for saying that.
Well, yeah, I'm not a terrorist. I'm not inclined to violence. But I was a little girl. And as a child, I tended to trust and believe the things that I was told.
By adults.
By adults, mm-hmm. In particular, yes. And that is instrumental in what is true about Valley, that she is a person who has a deep innocence. As a terrorist, she is deeply innocent. She believes wholeheartedly that what she is doing is the best thing she can do for the world. This is her self-sacrifice for good.
As she sees it.
As she's been taught right. To see it.
Well, one of the things that is really striking about the story is that Valley has not been allowed to be out in the world. She's been totally isolated by her father. And I don't even think there's any record of her birth, is there?
No. Yeah. That's a part of the story, is that he has always been more than a little suspicious of the government and the government's interest in him. And he's been very protective of his family. He has kept them out of sight, out of mind. Nobody knows they exist.
Her and her brother.
He is motivated also by what he believes is right. This is, again, a thing we need to understand. He's not saying, I want to be evil to my children. He loves his children very, very much. Circumstances, however, have misshapen that love, and the results are not what he would have intended, perhaps.
Yeah, part of how he shows his love is to protect them and keep them safe, which he does by telling them to get into like a little underground bunker type situation when he's away from their place, which is out in the country. So he has his own ways of showing that he loves them, but they aren't what everybody else or most people in society would think of.
Yeah, it's fair to say he's not culturally normative in his parenting methods, but there's a lot of parents who are very disturbed at the idea that anyone else should judge the way they raise their children. It's quite
most of
alien.
Us.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, it's quite alien. And one of the most essential things that I hope I accomplish in my book is demonstrating that these people are not that different than us.
I got that from the book. I definitely did. And I started to see people who commit terrorism in a whole different way, which is why I think the book is really valuable. Well, when the book opens, Valley's about to go on a mission and she's being prepared. That's the first chapter. And then in the second chapter, you write about her early life, which gives the reader insight into the fact that she might be open to committing an act of terrorism. Do you mind just reading that chapter?
Sure. Yeah. I'd like to say one thing. It's important in this book that we're always living in Valley's head. We have no external measures, really, to speak of. I didn't want to introduce anything else. And in this chapter in particular, we're in the head of a very young child. When we remember ourselves, how we experienced things when we were five, you should try it as an exercise. Yeah, maybe you're that hovering adult, but there's also those flashes of things that somehow seem significant to your five-year-old self.
And that was another great thing about this book. You were forced as a reader to go back and try to remember what it was like not to have any point of reference. The only thing you knew was what your parents told you and your immediate environment. And so if your immediate environment was very, very narrow, as Valley's was, it would be quite easy to misinterpret things.
Yes. 11 years ago, we are sitting at the table. I'm eating peanut butter and jam. Di is teaching Bo some numbers. We all hear the helicopter. Pock-a-pock-pock-pock-pock-pock-pock-pock. It is right over the house where we sit at the table. I am eating peanut butter and jam. Mabby is outside, in the garden, picking beans. The sun is high, and it is the best time to pick them. I'm going to help. I must pick them carefully, each bean. I must not tug and tear the vines. I must leave the tiny beans to grow until the day after tomorrow. First, I must eat my peanut butter and jam and show Da how I can read. He, me, be, we. I can read. My, try, sky, fly. Now, Mabby, the garden, the beans, the tiny beans for the day after tomorrow. But the day after tomorrow doesn't come. Mabby is sleeping in the dirt. Da runs to Mabby in the garden. He turns her face to the sky, but her eyes don't blink. He puts his finger on her throat. He pulls his hand back like Mabby is a stove full of fire. There isn't a mark on her. No blood. No cuts. The beans spill out of the colander. The vines are mashed and broken where she fell. When she wakes up, she is going to be angry about the beans. Get to the house, Da says. Then he picks up Mabby and carries her to the truck. When it is dark, Bo makes me drink some milk and go to bed. In the morning, Da is there, but Mabby isn't. Mabby never again. When a piece is gone from the game, the whole game changes. That's how it is for us. Mabby was a really important piece. We used to eat vegetables from the garden and eggs from the chickens. We used to drink milk from the goats. But the garden, the chickens, the goats, those were Mabi's deal. She took care of all that. She planted and weeded and picked. She fed the chickens and gathered the eggs and butchered the chickens that didn't lay eggs. She milked the goats morning and evening. Now Mabi's gone. Those things don't happen. Da can't do that stuff because he has to go to work sometimes. The goats go first. Da loads them in the back of the truck and they go away. After that, we drink milk out of cans. That milk isn't good. It's gloopy and yellow and smells funny. Da says we have to drink it anyway, or our bones will get soft. Bo and I tried to help with the chickens, but we let them get out. That's okay for a while, but then they wandered away, or coyotes stole them. No eggs. Da said that didn't matter. Meat is as good as eggs. Meat makes muscles. Then the snow comes and covers the garden. We still have jars of food that Mabi made, but when they are emptied, we never fill them up again. Da just throws them out into the place where the garden used to be. Sometimes the jars break. Da says we should never go in Mabi's garden because we might get hurt on the broken glass. After a while, we never eat Mabi food anymore. We eat survival food and MREs. Da lets us put ketchup and syrup on it. That makes it better. Come out here, yells Da. I wonder what we did wrong. I don't want to get hit. When Da yells, sometimes he hits too. I hope it was Bo, not me. But if Bo did it, I probably did it too. Da dumps a lump and rag of blood and fur out of a bag. It's a coyote. It was a coyote. Now it's an empty body. A tail, paws pacing without moving. It has teeth, a tongue, and a bullet hole in the gut. Da picks up the coyote and hangs it over the wide black post by the gate to our property. Get me the hammer and a big nail, says Da. We run. Bo carries the hammer. I carry the nail. Hold this here, Da says to Bo. He means the dead body of the coyote. I hold out the big nail before Da asks. Da adjusts the coyote so the head is right on top of the post and says, keep it right there. I step up to help Bo, but I'm careful not to get in the way. I grab the fur on the coyote's shoulder and push it hard against the fence post. I'm doing my part. Da shoves the spike into one of the coyote's eyes. Then he brings the hammer down. Bone crunches and blood spatters. I turn my head and shut my eyes. I don't want coyote blood in my eyes. It's done, says Da. When you see this, I want you to remember those people will kill us like coyotes. We're nothing to them but coyotes. That's why we must stay in the den when he's away working. Otherwise, those people will kill us like coyotes. What do you do if black helicopters come? Da asks. Hide, I say. Hide where? Da asks. In the den, I say. What do you do if you hear a helicopter while you're outside? Da says. Hide, I say. Hide where? Da asks. I hide in mineral, I say. Be specific, says Da. Under truck, metal roof, cut bank, big rock. Da falls silent. I know he's thinking about Mabi. He will never forget about Mabi. He reaches out and pets my hair. Good girl, Valley. Good girl. The den is a safe place Da made for us under the floor. It's big enough for one bunk. Bo and I have to sleep heads to tails, but we each have our own sleeping bag. I say Bo's feet smell. He says mine do too. Sometimes we have kick fights, but that isn't fun for very long. I'm surprised sometimes that Bo isn't me. I'm the girl, he's the boy. I know that. Different bodies. I know that. We know that. We sleep in the same bunk. We know. Da gives us books and clocks to make the time go faster when he's away. We read the books. Fox, socks, box. And the clocks? Well, he's gone, We used tiny screwdrivers and tweezers to take them apart. Sometimes we worked together, four hands on one clock. "Put this together again," says Da. "See if you can make the pieces fit and make it tick." So then that is what we want to do. We take them apart to see how they tick. We put them together and listen to them talk. Da is very proud of us. Tick, tick, tick. Talk, talk, talk. Bo is Bo. I am me. And together we are we. We fix clocks. We wear socks. We fix clocks while we wear socks.
You've been listening to Blythe Wolston read from her young adult novel, Black Helicopters. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. You can find more information about Black Helicopters at mtpr.org/twq. We'll continue our conversation right after a short break. Don't go away.
Valley's dad refers to himself and his children as free people. Why, according to him, are other people not free?
That's kind of a complicated question, because it really has to do with the notion that he has of himself and his personal identity and how he has separated himself from the rest of the world. He thinks they're not thinking. They're not understanding the threat posed, the threat that he perceives that's posed to them and their freedom. He would basically perceive every single effort on the part of the government, for example, to know who you are or where you are or what you're doing to be an invasion that ruins freedom. What I want people to understand is this book is not ideologically driven. This book is not promulgating a particular ideology, and that's really hard. I think everybody wants to just line up behind their ideology at this point and say, we've solved the problem and this is the way we solve it. We get rid of all those people with that ideology. That is not going to work. That is only going to exacerbate all of our problems.
I didn't see you doing that in this book. What I saw was you presenting a scenario from the point of view of a little girl who had been isolated, and her father obviously was anti-government, and I thought maybe his idea of free people were people who could do whatever they wanted to without the government forcing them to get an ID.
Exactly.
Or stand in a security line for the airport.
He makes a few concessions, but they're just dodges. It's like he's always hiding. He is constantly hiding. Or one thing I'd like to mention is that when I was first starting to conceive this book, a question that crossed my mind was, What would happen if the Unabomber had children? What if the Unabomber had been, instead of a single isolated individual, a family man? What would be the repercussions of that? And I think that's what we're looking at. When a person is entirely invested in the belief that they have to do something to destroy an omnipresent them, terrible things can happen.
Right. When you're excluding an entire group of others, then you're always at war with somebody in some way, whether it's arguing or bombing.
Yeah. And it really comes down to, is there any way that we can formulate ourself without insisting that everyone else is wrong? Mm-hmm. Just because they aren't us. And the best thing is me, the next layer out, my family, and sometimes that's as far as that boundary goes, and the next layer out is my community, however that community may be defined, and then sometimes people look at their nation state, right? Mm-hmm. And then we start finding that nation states, individuals, families, communities are all in conflict with one another all the time, because what we're really defining ourselves with is the way we are different and therefore superior. And we can't seem to get to a point where we say, you know, perhaps we could negotiate a different kind of equitable situation. I'm very interested in the notions of equality and justice. I would say, weirdly enough, Valley's father is also very interested in the notion of justice. But equality may not be as big a deal for him. Justice without a sense of equal justice can really go awry.
Yeah, he seemed to want everybody to conform to his way of thinking. He judged everybody who didn't. Anyway, it's so complicated because we are all in this country together, but we all seem to be fighting outside forces all of the time. And the other is in our country in the form of different belief systems and different races, and the other is outside of our country.
Yeah, and so many others. And what it really comes down to with terrorism is that you've decided that fear is going to be your weapon. The problem with using fear as a weapon, unlike most weapons or swords, it's pointy at both ends. You do as much harm to yourself as you ever do to the other, because you are also living in that fear. Fear begets fear. Fear, that is what gives terrorists their power. Fear. And what is the best way to eliminate fear? Knowledge, understanding, comprehension.
That's why I wanted to talk with you about this book, because it is something that I think opens up a person's mind to look into how it might look from the other side. Black Helicopters was published near the end of March, and less than 3 weeks later, the Boston Marathon bombings happened. What were you thinking on that day?
Well, I probably, like everyone, the initial thing is simply terror and shock, because that's how terrorism works. There was a lot of anxiety for me. I'm here, although, for example, my editor lives in Boston, the editor who worked on this book with me. It wasn't like I necessarily knew anyone who was hurt, but I thought, this is, again, an example of what I don't want for the rest of the world. I have children. You know, most of us have children. And one of the things that I did recently was, I was in the classroom when they had a bomb drill here in Billings. And to watch five-year-olds being moved out of their school, hopefully to shelter in a safe place, to know that my older son now has, through his entire life in school, had part of the normal experience being knowing how to lock down. This is not what we want to give to our children if we want them to feel free. This is contrary to freedom. We are inculcating our children with terror ourselves, because we're not willing somehow to grapple with this hard problem. And again, I don't know the entire answer. I have more questions than answers. But I think the people who think there's an easy answer to this are completely wrong. We really need to rethink this situation. And it isn't that it's an entirely new problem. It isn't. Of course, when Boston happened, we were reminded that more than 100 years ago, there were anarchists who planted bombs in Boston for the same kind of purpose, to move their political agenda or whatever. But I'll tell you one thing with Boston, I'd have to say the uncle was not entirely wrong. Those boys were kind of lost. He called them losers, but I'd say those were lost boys. And it's wrong to call them boys. For crying out loud, the guy has a child. The older brother had a child. But when you see that younger brother in particular, who's 19, yes, he'd be functioning as an adult now. I have a 19-year-old. I know how well they function as adults. Yeah, marginal. Some ways, absolutely. Other ways, not so great every day, although I love him desperately. When we saw that happening, well, there were some very strange reactions. Like one of the first media preoccupations was their race. And then it's their religion. And then it's a variety of other things, but it never seemed to be what is most concerning. You cannot be radicalized to the point where you would do that kind of activity if you had better options in your life. If you were feeling really good about your life, if you weren't a lost boy, you aren't going to do that. And frankly, if Valley hadn't been a lost girl, profoundly lost, she wouldn't have made the choices that she did either.
And well indoctrinated.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and as far as indoctrination goes, there are two ways that you can challenge that or resist that. One way is to try to shut down those channels of information. The other way is to make sure that many, many, many channels of information flourish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like lots of books.
Yes, lots of
points of view.
That's right. That's right. If there's any reason why we need to cultivate right now freedom of speech, it's because this is our real freedom, the real freedom that people like Malala, the girl who was shot in the head going to school, that's the freedom she was exercising.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing that really terrifies them. And it doesn't belong to America. It belongs to all of us. And I think we really need to exercise that.
Blythe Woolston lives in Billings, Montana. Look for information about her and Black Helicopters at mtpr.org/twq. And while you're there, click over to our Facebook page and sign up for our podcast.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.